This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Annual Hajj pilgrimage is nearing its end in the holy city of Mecca. Muslims around the world celebrating Eid al-Adha. Tehran says any groundwork for increasing Washington's role in regional security mechanisms will only lead to instability and spread of terrorism. Calm returns to Sri Lanka's commercial capital, Colombo, following violent protests that forced the president and the prime minister to resign. From Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Our top story this hour, hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims are performing the final rituals of the Hajj pilgrimage in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. One of these rituals is tawaf, or walking in procession around the Kaaba 7 times. Kaaba is the direction Muslims always face while praying. Another ritual is the stoning of the devil, in which pilgrims threw pebbles at a rock, symbolizing the Satan. The rituals culminate in Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. On this day, animals are sacrificed to commemorate Prophet Abraham's decision to sacrifice his son in the name of Almighty God. Another essential part of the Hajj pilgrimage is the shaving of the head for men. Women will only cut the tips of their hair. Eid al-Adha is celebrated in Muslim countries around the world. The date varies by one day in different countries, depending on lunar sightings. Iranians are marking the occasion today. Iran slamming as provocative a plan by the U.S. to advance partnership for air defense among Washington's allies in the Middle East. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Washington raises such issues in an attempt to create Iranophobia and discord among regional countries, while it has no proper understanding of the realities in the region. The official noted attempts to create new security concerns in the region will have no result other than tension and insecurity. He said promoting Iranophobia won't create a safe margin for Israel. Adding any groundwork for increasing the role of the U.S. in regional security mechanisms will only lead to instability and the spread of terrorism. On Thursday, White House spokesman John Kirby said that U.S. officials are discussing ways of integrating air defense capabilities with regional leaders in the face of what are called a threat from Iran. And this days ahead of the U.S. president's visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel. In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden is defending his decision to visit Saudi Arabia and meet with his crown prince, despite criticism that he is abandoning his own stated concerns about a kingdom's human rights record. Biden has written in an opinion piece for the Washington Post that his upcoming visit aims to strengthen the strategic partnership with Riyadh. Biden says that the U.S. will use Saudi Arabia's vital energy resources to mitigate the impact of the war in Ukraine on global supplies, and that amid surging fuel costs and inflation at home. But the visit goes against Biden's repeated pledges to make Saudi Arabia pay for the killing and dismemberment of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. Biden's administration has released intelligence findings showing Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman masterminded Khashoggi's murder. Now, polls open across Japan for the upper house of parliament elections, which is overshadowed by the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The vote is expected to expand the majority of Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner. The party already enjoys a solid majority in parliament. The vote takes place just 2 days after Abe was assassinated while on the campaign trail. The suspect is in custody and has told investigators he targeted Abe because he believed that a politician was linked to an unnamed organization. The head of the police in the area where Abe was killed has admitted that there were undeniable flaws in security for the former prime minister. We also have this breaking news for you that Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency in advance of a plan to inject uranium gas into IR-6 centrifuges in a cluster. This is the latest regarding Iran's peaceful nuclear program, and this piece of news has to do with Iran still informing the IAEA about what it is doing. Now, the murder of Japan's best-known politician, Shinzo Abe, is rattling the country and sending shockwaves around the world. Let's check out some reactions posted online.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another hashtag trending. On Friday morning, an unusual act of political violence shocked Japan and the whole world. Japan's longest-running modern leader, Shinzo Abe, was gunned down while delivering a campaign speech. Abe was assassinated by a 41-year-old man in a deed decried by the political establishment as an attack on democracy itself, shocking a country where guns are tightly controlled and political violence is almost unthinkable. Abe had been making a campaign speech outside a train station when two shots rang out. The assassination sent shockwaves throughout the world as post-war Japan prides itself in its orderly democracy. Our first tweet of the day comes from Mark Marikong. Perhaps ordinary Japanese people, me included, worry a lot more about earthquakes than gun incidents. That's why the assassination of Mr. Abe was all the more shocking. We were naive in believing it can't happen here. Antoine Fletcher said, assassination is a grotesque act of cowardice. It should not be celebrated or encouraged. It is the murder of a man by a scoundrel unwilling to fight the armies who stand behind the assassinated. And over here, a comment by John Hernlund reads, the assassination of Shinzo Abe is a terrible tragedy. I want to express my condolences to all Japanese people who have worked hard to build and maintain a peaceful society without this kind of political violence. The assassin will not succeed in destroying these achievements. Tina has our next tweet, still in shock about former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's assassination. Violent crimes in Japan are very rare, which has truly rattled this country's sense of identity as a peaceful country. There are conflicting reports about the probable motives behind the assassination of Shinzo Abe, but investigative sources say that the suspect had a grudge against a specific organization, possibly a religious group, that he believed was linked to Abe. Our next comment says, before the assassination of Shinzo Abe, the most recent political assassination in Japan was in 1960, when a 17-year-old assassinated the leader of the Socialist Party with a sword. Julia Mio Inuma has our next comment. The assassination of Japanese leader Shinzo Abe rocked a country where strict firearms laws mean gun violence is almost unheard of, as a procession of mourners laid flowers near the site of the shooting to honor the country's longest-serving prime minister. Imran Khan tweeted, Shinzo Abe death. The murderer's heart was filled with hatred for the religious organization Shinzo Abe was associated with, the real reason behind the murder. Shinzo Abe's assassination. Know why the murderer killed Shinzo Abe, said to be hated the religious group. Messages of sympathy and shock poured in from around the world following the news of Abe's death. including ones from the neighboring Taiwan, China, and Russia, as well as from across Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Abe is best known for his Abenomics policy of aggressive monetary easing and fiscal spending. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Alive. Whoever planned this already failed with Abe's assassination. This will further strengthen ideas of Abe about reconsidering the position of Japan post-1945 socially and militarily. This incident will speed up Japan's move towards a more anti-China and non-US-based security apparatus. Dr. Samuel Chapman has our next tweet. In the same way that mass shootings inspire copycats in America, I worry that Abe's assassination will do the same, but in other countries, not just Japan. It seems like it was a shocking, flagrant, egotistical attack, just like a mass shooting, so ripe for copying. Tom Boatman tweeted, apparently Yamagami, Abe's killer, was upset with Abe being an advocate of the cult-like unification church of Japan, Toitsu Kyokai, which Yamagami believed ruined his life. Japan's mainstream media is downplaying or simply not understanding this point. And our final comment comes from Pamela Valmont. Abe's assassination and Johnson's deposing are symptomatic of a much deeper plus more terrifying problem, approaching economic disaster in those countries who choose to implement sanctions against Russia. Winter cold, food rationing, plus shortages, plus no heating gas, plus petrol looming. That's a wrap for another Hashtag Trending.
Now moving on, it's calm after a storm in Sri Lanka, where anti-government protesters are in celebratory mood following the resignation of both the president and the prime minister. In capital Colombo, protesters could still be seen milling around in President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence after storming it a day before. Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's private home was also set on fire in a rare public display of fury. That was a dramatic escalation of a month-long public anger over the government's handling of a deepening economic crisis. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation, which hit a record high of 54% in June. Despite the resignations, chaos is far from over. Details of a transition of power and the complexion of the next government are still not clear. I was spoken to Chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Jahan Pereira. As a person who has personally taken part in street rallies in Colombo, he talks about what it is that the Sri Lankan people are actually demanding.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time. That footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it, they are taking a swim, they are touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful that, now there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
The Argentines have taken to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest the agreement between the government of President Alberto Fernandez and the National Monetary Fund. Protesters carried banners and placards that read, "Out with the IMF and no to paying the debt," saying that international financial institution brings them nothing but misery and dependency. Argentina recently reached a deal with the IMF to restructure a $44 billion bailout. The government says that the agreement will not affect social spending, but opponents say that the deal largely burdens people. Last week, Economy Minister Martin Guzman resigned amid tensions on how to handle the economic crisis. Inflation in Argentina is running above 60%, while the South American country is experiencing a fall of its currency's value and an unstable financial market. As Russia continues to make gains in Donbass, John Amendel reports from the city that most recently was taken over by Russian forces.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, it's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. This is the small settlement of Toshkivka. There's so much destruction, it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we passed that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight. Although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting, a statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II, Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control. The Russian army has set up a museum on the street, tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements related to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes has a report from the Belgian capital.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much. Unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour take over something, I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
وَنَادَيْنَاهُ أَنْ يَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ قَدْ صَدَّقْتَ الرُّؤْيَا إِنَّا كَذَلِكَ نَجْزِي الْمُحْسِنِينَ
And we called out to him saying, O Ibrahim, you have indeed shown the truth of the vision. Surely thus do we reward the doers of good. Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, celebrates and honors the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The inspirational message of Eid al-Adha. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and congratulations to you on the auspicious Feast of Qurban, or Eid al-Adha, that marks the culmination of the Hajj pilgrimage and commemorates Prophet Abraham's great sacrifice of his son Ishmael, who, by the command of God Almighty, was saved at the last moment. Here is a special feature for you, so please stay with us. In Ayah 120 of Surah Nahl of the Noble Quran, God Almighty says, "Surely Abraham was an exemplar, obedient to God and upright, and he was not of the polytheists." We also read in Ayah 4 of Surah Mumtahine, or the Examined One, "Indeed, there is for you an excellent exemplar in Abraham and those with him, when they said to their people, 'Surely we are clear of what you serve besides Allah. And enmity and hatred have appeared between us and you forever until you believe in Allah.'" As is clear, the words of God are self-explanatory concerning the monotheistic stature of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, and the annual Hajj pilgrimage that reaches its climax amidst the celebration of Eid al-Adha or Eid al-Qurban, the Feast of Sacrifice. The Hajj is undoubtedly the glorious manifestation of monotheism, universalized by Abraham on God's command, after he and his firstborn son Ishmael were ordered to rebuild the ancient edifice of Adam, the holy Kaaba, which was in a state of ruin in the wilderness of Mecca following the deluge of the days of Prophet Noah, peace be upon him. When God asked him to proclaim the pilgrimage for mankind, he wondered who will come to the remote wilderness of Mecca, but was told that people will come from all over the earth, from every beaten track, on various means of transport. Today, millions of people from around the world pour into Mecca almost the year around, peaking during the annual Hajj, to tread in the footsteps of Abraham and to circumambulate the Kaaba, the focal point of monotheism. They ritually stone the symbolic satans at Mina, and they sacrifice a sheep, goat, cow, or camel on the 10th of Dhul-Hajj in commemoration of Abraham's sacrifice of Ishmael that was miraculously substituted by the command of God with the ram before the ancient father's knife could reach the patient son's throat. As God Almighty says in Ayah 107 of Surah Safat, "And we ransomed him with the great sacrifice." The Muslims are proud to call themselves as heirs of Prophet Abraham in view of the fact that the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the direct descendant of Prophet Ishmael and revived for mankind the forgotten Abrahamic legacy.
This is an excellent heritage indeed. But are the Muslims, especially the Hajis, truly observing the example set by that immortal iconoclast who in his youth had smashed the idols of Babylon and underwent the ordeal of fire that miraculously turned into a garden to the horror of that hegemonic tyrant Nimrod? Are they really aware of the great sacrifice that ransomed Ishmael in antiquity? The questions are worth pondering on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, which ought not to be a mere soulless ritual. A true adherent of the School of Abraham cannot submit to each and everyone, especially the satanic and hegemonic Nimrod-like powers of the day, and then call himself a Muslim by paying lip service to Islam on the assumption that he or she recites the Quran, performs the Hajj, and prays punctually facing the Kaaba. No, the Hajj and Eid al-Adha have a great message. They want us to be free persons in the service of God only. The might and grandeur of the godless cannot overawe us. We should turn over the folios of history to see the fate of those who opposed monotheism. There are no signs today of the elaborately carved and richly decorated temples of Babylon built by the powerful who toyed with the life of human beings, while Abraham's simple cube-shaped structure stands majestically in Mecca. We should also ask ourselves as to who saved the sanctity of the edifice of Adam and Abraham. The Noble Quran says it was the great sacrifice. But this great sacrifice cannot be an insignificant ram, as the ignorant might believe, although for the time being, Ishmael was saved by substituting of a ram. Ishmael's real ransom had to be greater than Ishmael himself, since Abraham's slaughtering of his son in antiquity in obscure Mecca would not have served any divine purpose. We find the answer in the full limelight of history when we reflect on events that ensured immortality for Islam and the endeavors of all previous prophets of God. In fact, it was on 10th of Muharram in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 of the Christian calendar, that God's words of the great sacrifice to ransom Ishmael came through on the plain of Karbala beside the river Euphrates. Here, the son and successor of Adam, Noah, Abraham, Ishmael, and Muhammad was mercilessly slain, thirsty, after witnessing the tragic slaughter of his brothers, kinsmen, companions, and two sons of his own sons, an 18-year-old youth who resembled his beloved grandfather, the prophet, and a six-month-old infant. Thus, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the son of Imam Ali, peace upon him, was the great sacrifice that not just ransomed Abraham and Ishmael, but salvaged Islam and all humanitarian values. These are the points to ponder during the Hajj and on Eid al-Adha. Congratulations once again and goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Police accountability in the UK. Britain has been rocked by scandal upon scandal from its police force. The organisation has been repeatedly found wanting when it comes to stamping out corrupt and criminal behaviour in its ranks. My name is Michael Doherty. I'm a civil liberties campaigner and founder of Justice Now. I seek to bring about fundamental change to the systems of police accountability in the UK. Lee Bulkwell died in suspicious circumstances in the summer of 2002. The police have declared it a freak accident, but his father suspects murder. Les had concerns about the conduct of the police at the scene of Lee's death, and dozens of misconduct charges have been upheld against officers who investigated it. Despite countless reviews of the case, Lee's father feels we are no closer to seeing justice for his son.
He said that the arms and hands were not part of the trauma in the drum. Well, if they weren't part of the trauma in the drum, where did the injuries come from? They're on the hands and the arms.
And was then placed in the on the concrete mixer. The people who owned the farm there would have switched on the cement mixer. There's absolutely no doubt that that could not have happened by an accident.
I've come to the end of the line, Upminster, the very furthest east in London. In July 2002, a man by the name of Lee Bulkwell died in this suburb in the middle of the night. When emergency services arrived on scene, they didn't know what to make of it. They found a dead man hanging out of a cement mixer at 1 a.m. Was this a bizarre accident or something more sinister?
The dead man's name was Lee Bulkwell. And even now, 12 years later, his father is still fighting to get to the truth of what happened to his son.
The scene that they found was a lorry parked, and my son's body was wedged between the drum of that lorry, which was a cement mixing lorry, and the chassis.
Here you can see one of the lorry's two identical access hatches. Lee's arms and head have been trapped inside the hatch. His body was outside as a drum had revolved. His body was caught between the chassis of the vehicle and the drum as it turned, causing severe injuries to his torso. The situation seems suspicious, purely by virtue of how unusual it is. Tony Bennett represents and advises Lee Bulkwell.
The only thing really for the police to decide was this foul play or not. And some of the ambulance and fire crew were very observant, and there were all sorts of indications at that stage that this could not have been an accident.
This is CCTV footage from Baldwin's farm where Lee died. The ambulance arrives and the crew rush to the concrete mixer. There was nothing they could do. Lee had died instantly. One paramedic wrote in his pocketbook that this death could be due to foul play. Another also felt that it was a suspicious death, and a third reluctant to touch the body in case they damaged important evidence.
According to the initial investigation, how did Lee die?
The initial investigation worked on the basis that it was an accident, although at around about 2:30 a.m. on that morning, there must have been some honest police officers at the scene because they declared it a suspicious death.
The police would revert to the opinion that this was a freak accident and would state that they have investigated all possibilities thoroughly. They maintain that Lee Bulkwell and Simon Bromley were cleaning the inside of the concrete mixer, using drills to remove hardened concrete from the inside of the drum. They had taken it in turns to climb out, switch on the engine, and very slowly rotate the drum so they could clean the next section of it. On one occasion, Simon Bromley went to switch the engine on, and a mechanical failure caused the drum to immediately and rapidly spin. Lee had for some reason tried to climb out through a maintenance hatch and was halfway out when this failure occurred, trapping him between the drum and the chassis, killing him instantly. Les Bulkwell and Tony Bennett strongly disagree with the police's assessment and believe a very different sequence of events unfolded.
This is the farm where Lee met his death back in 2002. It's owned by the Bromley family, a family that's had a checkered history with the police over the years. Lee was employed there back in 2002 when he met his death. Les, his father, believes that there was criminal activity involved in the death of his son.
And how do you believe Lee died?
My belief from information we've received is that Simon Bromley suspected my son of having a fling or an affair with his partner, Sue Lawrence, and he was called. He had actually left at 11:35. We have no doubt that he'd socialised with them, perhaps had a lager, game of pool, and left. But they had had a large delivery of cocaine to that farm that night. And my belief is that they got high on the cocaine. They suspected Lee of having an affair. We believe he was called back, attacked soon after being called back, badly attacked.
And was then placed by members of the family at the farm on the concrete mixer. The people who owned the farm there would have switched on the cement mixer, and the inspection hole would have come round, taken his head and shoulders below, left the rest of his body outside. That's quite clear from the photographs. There's absolutely no doubt that that could not have happened by an accident.
Les eventually managed to obtain photos from his son's post-mortem. He points out injuries on Lee's body that are not explained by the police's version of events, and says that they support his theory of how Lee died.
But what we believe is that something's been tied around his wrist, and a forensic photographer has given that opinion. The bloke who's spent 20 to 30 years photographing these sort of things. And he said, unfortunately, Mr. Ball, well, I have to tell you that it appears your son has been restrained by something tied around his wrist. Secondly, this, what I say, is a cut on the palm. The opinion given by people who are not regarded as experts but have experienced similar things say that looks like a classic defence wound where Lee has protected himself and grabbed the blade, and as they pulled the blade out, it's cut through the palm of the hand.
In Dr. Swift's original opinions of Lees, he said that the arms and hands were not part of the trauma in the drum. Well, if they weren't part of the trauma in the drum, where did the injuries come from? They're on the hands and the arms. For example, he said the hands and arms were not part of the trauma in the drum. Where did all this come from then? He's telling us they come from somewhere else, isn't he?
Yeah.
But the police, when you try to speak to them about this, they ignore these as though they're not there. We need answers.
The police pathologist's opinion was that all of Lee's injuries were either caused by the drum of the concrete mixer or were caused after death by the fireman's attempts to free him from the lorry. It was a long and difficult process. The police have stuck to this view through several examinations of Lee's body. Les had concerns about the conduct of the police at the scene of Lee's death and did not feel that the investigation was carried out properly. Complaints about this were lodged. Had key witnesses been identified and interviewed in a proper way? Was evidence seized and secured in a timely manner? It was 2003 when these complaints were made. Essex Police carried out an investigation into these complaints, but came to the conclusion that the officers involved had done their jobs properly and that the overall operation had been executed as it should have been. This was not the last that Essex Police would hear of these complaints, but more on that later.
Les says his concerns with the police were not limited to the investigations at the scene of his son's death. Many of his interactions with the police since that night in 2002 have caused him massive concern.
The issue of what happened to Lee's clothing is one such concern for his father.
We was led to believe right up until October of 2002 that the police still had the clothing, but it was needed for forensics. Well, we now know that was a lie because they never done no forensics. And as has come out in the last 18 months, 2 years, documents have been found that show that the SIO, Graham Ball, had ordered the destruction of my son's clothing within 24 hours of him being removed from the drum.
And is there any explanation as to why they destroyed evidence so early on in the case?
They said that Lee's partner didn't want them. But that's got nothing to do with forensics. I didn't want them, but I wanted them to keep them and do a forensic study of the clothing because we thought there'd been something untoward happened and there could have been a transfer of body fluids or DNA or whatever.
The Bromleys had a CCTV system at Baldwin's farm. Many cameras all linked into one system. Les requested a copy of the CCTV after viewing some of it with his daughter at a police station. But the tapes he was sent were incomplete. There was 1 hour of footage missing in between the two tapes, and more importantly, they showed the view of only one camera. When Les complained about this, he got a strange reaction. The police sent a new tape without acknowledging their earlier mistake. The new tape matched what Les had seen at the police station, showing several other camera views at the very start, but only for fractions of a second each. The police footage from the morning after Lee's death shows the concrete mixer parked opposite the Bromleys' property. On the side of the house, you can just make out a CCTV camera. Here it can be seen more clearly, just above the fence, pointing out over the road towards the concrete mixer. The frame from the CCTV tape is undoubtedly filmed by that camera, just above the fence, and has a clear view of where the concrete mixer was parked. Footage from this camera would solve Lee's death in a heartbeat. So where is it? The police assert that this single second of video is all they have from this crucial camera. Did the police at the scene of Lee's death fail to seize all of the necessary tapes? Had the footage been tampered with before they got there? After 12 years, it's impossible to know. Terry Haynes was the name of the officer who supplied the first two tapes to Les. And later, charges of misconduct were upheld against him for doing so.
Well, the importance about these tapes is they do not carry the Essex Technical Department's logo or a job number, whatever you want to call it. So if a police officer supplied tapes that weren't made by the Technical Department, who has made them? He's going to have to answer the question.
Haynes resigned when he was told that he would be interviewed by the Independent Police Complaints Commission.
What he also said was he made this statement to the IPCC that he's not prepared to cooperate with the investigation or the inquiry. That is in black and white. Mm-hmm. I wonder why. It's funny, that, isn't it?
We inquired as to why this CCTV is missing, but Essex Police elected not to give us an answer to our questions. Lee Boldwell died in 2002, but it wasn't until 2008 that his inquest was held here in Chelmsford. But it wasn't just a six-year wait for an inquest. This was the third attempt. The first two failed under very strange circumstances.
Les Boldwell, in the lead-up to that inquest, he had a meeting at Brentwood Police Station with the detective constable who was taking an interview from him at the time. And during that interview, the detective inspector, I'll give his name, Ian Rayner, took a phone call from a man called Derek Bynes, who had been appointed as the coroner's officer. And he was heard on the telephone by Les Boldwell to say, look, I'm going to run this inquest as an accidental death. Les Boldwell heard it, mentioned it to the officer. The officer wrote a report up on it, confirming that those words had been said. And to cut a long story short, as a result of that, the solicitor made representations and Derek Bynes was taken off the case. Clearly corrupt, to try to manipulate a whole inquest as an accident.
The next attempt at an inquest also ended in failure. When the inquest did at last get underway, it lasted 9 days and marked an important shift in the focus of the case.
Les Boldwell's barrister Tony Ventham said quite clearly in private submission to the coroner, there is overwhelming circumstantial evidence that Lee Boldwell was murdered, overwhelming circumstantial evidence. The coroner said, no, I'm not putting that to the jury, there's not enough evidence. So the jury's range of options was limited, but the jury said that he was killed by, the verdict was gross negligence manslaughter. Basically, was suggesting that he was killed by the fault of the people on the farm, but not alleging deliberate intent.
Meanwhile, as the inquest was going on, a new investigation had just begun into the conduct of the police. The Independent Police Complaints Commission, the body that looks into complaints against police officers, was once again turning its eyes to the Boldwell case. But unlike in 2003, when they effectively allowed Essex Police to investigate themselves, the IPCC this time decided they should handle it personally. This time, the outcome was completely different.
26 separate complaints were upheld of misconduct. 13 against the Chief Superintendent Graham Bull, in other words, the most senior officer on the case. Another two against Detective Superintendent Gareth Wilson. And then various other officers, six other officers, total of 26 complaints. And just very briefly, the main complaints against the Chief Superintendent Graham Bull. Graham Bull failed to identify appropriate witnesses, failed to re-interview the leading suspect, Simon Bromley, when there was clear cause to do to. Forensic failures of many kinds, failed to consider the possibility of foul play.
The 2012 IPCC report resulted in yet another review of the case. Bit by bit, the old narrative was being overturned. The investigation was now labelled as seriously flawed by the IPCC. Action had to be taken.
And they recommended that there should be a brand new investigation by another police force, an outside police force, which is what we asked for. So, very clear recommendation. This is so bad, so flawed, that there must be a full reinvestigation. It didn't happen because the IPCC only has the legal power to recommend. It can't force a police force. So what Essex Police did was, first of all, delayed for 3 months, did nothing, basically. And then they put it out to West Midlands Police Force for, as you say, a review.
There was a review by West Midlands Police, led by a top officer named Chief Superintendent Muirfield, who found he made 91 recommendations to whoever whoever investigated after his review. The funny thing was that Essex flaffed about for 6 months before they sorted out Kent to do it.
Problem we've got with Kent, if I may say so briefly, is that Kent and Essex are very much merged, collaborating forces, sharing a lot of resources at the top level. They have a joint senior organised crime directorate with staff covering both forces. So the idea, Mike, that this was an independent force is false. So we've still never got what the IPCC recommended in 2009. Kent is not independent from Essex.
How can they investigate when you've got Mark Hall, Gareth Wilson, both involved in the Kent and Essex Serious Organised Crime Directorate, and yet they've been found guilty of misconduct within the case?
When we asked Kent Police why they had been selected to carry out this investigation, they told us to speak to Essex Police. Essex Police declined to comment on the matter. As part of the new investigation, the police sought to re-examine Lee's body. Almost 11 years after Lee's death, his body was to be exhumed. It was a sign that the police were taking the new investigation seriously. But over a decade later, was there really any useful evidence to be found? It was a blustery March night in 2013 when the police and the media descended on an Upminster cemetery. With the old investigation now discredited as a shambles, this was an opportunity to begin putting things right. Did the exhumation of Lee's body reveal anything previously unknown?
I can't tell you that for the simple reason that the police have refused to disclose the full report of Dr. Benjamin Swift, who carried out the report. Now, we have got a copy of the post-mortem report, which is a limited document on the main findings. The much longer report has not been disclosed to us. But I think it's fair to say that the exhumation didn't produce any surprises.
We asked Essex Police what the new exhumation revealed, if anything, and they wouldn't tell us either. Kent's investigation seemed far more focused and determined than the original Essex one. It brought with it something that Les Bulkwell had waited years for: arrests. Tony Bennett recounts what at first seemed like a breakthrough in the case.
Simon Bromley, he was arrested along with other members of his family. And he was arrested on suspicion of murder, is what the police told us. And then a whole year passed before the police then said that they were charging him for a gross negligence manslaughter.
In addition, Simon Bromley was also charged with violations of health and safety regulations. Four other people were arrested under suspicion of perjury and perverting the course of justice, but were never charged with anything. When we inquired as to why all of these severe charges had decreased or disappeared, Essex Police offered no comment.
The charge of gross negligence and manslaughter is back to the accident scenario. It's not an allegation of deliberate killing at all. It's an allegation that he negligently allowed this accident to happen. And neither I nor Les Bulkwell can possibly accept that because it's not compatible with the 141 evidential points that I've set out here. So what's been going on in the last few months, Mike, just to bring you up to date, is that we have been making strenuous efforts to stop this prosecution. And there doesn't seem to be any way of doing it. This prosecution is going to allow, we say, Simon Bromley to get away with saying, it was an accident and I've been punished for it. But it's a false prosecution because it flies in the face of the overwhelming circumstantial evidence that this was not an accident.
For it to be gross negligence, Lee had to be working at 1:03 in the morning, which he wasn't. Work had finished round about 9:30. There's so many different things that point to that. But they are cherry-picking and promoting now. We've got evidence that there was only a quarter of a metre of concrete left in that drum. What that equates to is about 50 minutes' work for one man. Now, they've maintained all along that there was two in that drum, Lee and Simon Bromley, so that should cut it down a bit. the 50 minutes is clean it out and wash it down, right? When the fire brigade turn up at 3 o'clock in the morning and do their photography and their videoing, it's all soaking wet, piles of water. That shows that the drum has been washed out. The drum only gets washed out at the end of play or the end of work or when you've cleaned it out and it's finished. Otherwise, you're getting straight inside with it soaking wet. There's no need. You just get rid of, you want to get rid of the concrete. Also, there's a small pile of slurry there. Now, that shows that the lorry had been washed out. Well, it obviously hadn't been washed out after Lee died because you've got a body half in. So it had been washed out before Lee died, which is the signing off signature or the signing off to say work's done. We've washed the lorry out. So how come Lee's body, if they've finished work, how come they're trying to prosecute Bromley for gross negligence? That has to happen when you're working. They weren't working.
Les theorises that when the concrete mixer drives off and returns after 9 p.m, it was collecting water to complete the cleaning of the drum. This could have been when work...